If you have been here on a regular basis, I hope this study has been beneficial for you as we have gone through the chapters of this book, and we are going to be looking at chapters 9 and 10 tonight of this book. Very practical book for us because there are a lot of things that the church in Corinth was dealing with that that folks are still dealing with today. What was it that Solomon said? That there's nothing new under the sun. And how true that is. You know, it's whether it be the immorality. Why were Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed? Because of immorality. What was causing troubles in the church in Corinth? Immorality. Are we having problems with immorality today? Not much has changed. You know, what seems to be sinful and evil and vile just continues to remain. And even fashion trends come and go, but then they come back, don't they? Isn't that the strangest thing? We were at a store the other day and we saw these thin ties. And Tracy said, are you serious? Are thin ties coming back? I mean, you know how the fashion has been with ties. You go from fat to skinny to middle. And I mean, I had a teacher in school, in college, who had an attic that probably had 200 or 300 ties up in his attic. He was just waiting for those styles to come back around. And he'd go up to his attic and get those 50-year-old ties and bring them back down. They were back in style. Anyway, book of 1 Corinthians, very practical for us because there's a lot of things that we can take and that we can make immediate application in our lives. We're going to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and 10 tonight, but I want to back up for just a minute to the end of chapter 8. Because when you look at 1 Corinthians 9 and 10, you are right in the middle of a context that Paul started back in chapter 8. He carries it all the way through chapter 10, and it's helpful to see this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul dealt with the fact that there were some Christians in the church in the city of Corinth who thought that it was sinful if they were to eat, or if someone else in the church was to eat meat that had been sacrificed, that came from an animal that had been sacrificed to an idol. If this animal had been laid on an altar and sacrificed to honor an idol, those Christians believed that it would be sinful to eat that meat because it was dedicated to that pagan god. Well, God says in this context that it's not sinful to eat that meat, unless it is not sinful unless by the eating of that meat you cause a weaker brother to stumble because he does believe that it's wrong. And by doing so, you would place a stumbling block before him. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 9, Paul says, but beware lest somehow this liberty of yours... You have the right to eat that meat, but be careful lest that liberty become a stumbling block to those who are weak. And if you use it in such a way, you can cause someone to stumble. Verse 12, he says, and when you thus sin against the brethren, you're just eating meat. And inherently that meat is not sinful to eat unless you're causing someone else to stumble. And if by doing something that causes my brother to stumble, if I do something that causes my brother to stumble, I sin against the brethren, wound their weak conscience. This is in 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 12. And I sin against Christ. Paul's conclusion in verse 13. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I'm not going to eat it. I never again will eat meat, lest my brother stumble. There was something more important to Paul than his own personal liberties. Did he have a right to eat that meat? Yes, unless it was going to cause his brother to stumble. And the soul and the salvation of his brother's soul was more important to him than the exercising of his own rights and liberties. So in chapter 9, Paul then begins to turn and to make an illustration of this principle using himself. And in chapter 9, he begins to defend the fact that he is an apostle, and yet as an apostle, Paul chose to not receive financial support from the church in Corinth. He makes the case in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 that he had every right to receive financial support from the church in Corinth. In fact, he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, that verse 14, that the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. They have every right to be supported financially by the work that they are doing. But Paul knew that there were some brethren who were going around and they were trying to undermine the fact that Paul was an apostle. And through this process, there were some who questioned the fact of Paul's sincerity. Well, if he's so determined to preach, if he thinks it's the most important thing to do is to take the gospel around the world, then why would he have to get money to do it? Who needs to be paid to preach to preach the gospel? Didn't God tell every Christian to go into all the world and preach the gospel? Is every Christian getting paid to preach the gospel? Well, if not, then Paul shouldn't either. And if he's asking for money, then he must be some kind of a swindler, some kind of a con man, and you better watch out and better not listen to him. Paul knew that there were all sorts of things out there being said, that if he were from the church in Corinth, if he were to receive financial support, which was his right and his liberty, he knew that it may cause some weaker brethren to stumble in their faith. And he said, that's not going to happen. I am not going to exercise that right that is mine, lest I cause a brother to stumble. His soul's salvation is more important to me than doing that very thing. And so we looked last week down in verse 19. Well, back up to verse 16, where Paul says, I might choose not to get paid by the church at Corinth, although he was paid. You keep reading in this book and in the next book that Paul was paid by other brethren, such as those in Philippi, that they were supporting him as a missionary. So he was being paid, but not specifically by this church. But Paul says, I can choose whether or not I will receive financial support from you. But he says in verse 16, I cannot choose whether or not I will preach. He says, necessity is laid upon me. Yes, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel of Christ. He wasn't going to stop. He was under compulsion to preach. Verse 17 says that he was entrusted with a stewardship, that God had entrusted the gospel into his hands. And so he says, when I preach, I cannot stop what I am doing because this is the will of God. You think about the fact that we ought to be also under compulsion to preach. We ought also recognize that we have been entrusted with a stewardship of the gospel. But Paul says in verse 19, he says, he began in verse 19 and he goes through verse 23. And we saw this last week and then we're going to pick up with verse 24, which we did not get to last time. Verse 19 of chapter 9, Paul says, Though I am free from all men, I'm not under legal obligation to them, I have made myself a servant. I've become a servant to all people. For what purpose? That I might win the more. Paul determined that the winning of souls was the most important thing that he could do. And so to the Jews in verse 20, he didn't become a Jew, he just became as a Jew. There were some things that they could understand and he would get down on their level. Why did he do that? That I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, I became as under the law. Why? That I might win them. Verse 21, to those who are without the law, as without the law. That's how he became, not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ. Why did he become as without law? That I might win those who are without the law, those Gentiles. Verse 20, or verse 22, to the weak, I became as one who is weak. Why did you do that, Paul? That I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means, not illegitimate or sinful means, but by all legitimate, righteous means, that I might save some. Paul says there is nothing more important than the salvation of souls. If I have to forego the right that I have to receive financial support in order that souls might be saved, I'll do it. If I'm among the Jews and I have to forego the right that God gave me to eat pork so that I don't offend them, I'll do it so that I can save souls. Paul looked at his desire for all of mankind to be saved and God's desire for all of mankind to be saved. And he says, I don't want to do anything else but win souls to Christ. And so he says in verse 23, now this I do. Notice what he says. He didn't do it for his own sake. He didn't do it for his own pride. I do this for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you. Y'all have any comments or questions? That's all kind of review of where we've been, but it's important for us to see the context so that we can finish this section. Any comments or questions that you want to make up to that point? Look at verse 24. You got to be quick. Pop those hands. Verse 24. Do you not know then that those who run in a race, what do they do? They run. Don't you know that all those who run in a race, they all run, but one receives the prize? Look at the end of verse 24. Run in such a way that you may obtain the prize. For everyone who competes, he's using athletic terminology here, everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. What does the word temperate mean? He's under control. He's exercising self-control. So back up to verse 24. When he says, run in such a way that you may obtain the prize, what is the in such a way? What kind of way am I supposed to run in order to receive the prize? Verse 25 says it's in a way where I'm exercising self-control. Do you notice that God does not say, run any way you want and you can get the prize? Did God ever say that in the Bible? You just run any way you want. You run any direction you want and you'll get the prize. No. God says, run in such a way. Did God tell us what way He wanted us to run? Well, one way is right here in verse 25. Everyone who competes for the prize must be temperate, controlled in all things. Now they do it to obtain, they do it in these Olympic races, they do it to obtain what kind of crown? Perishable. What kind of crown did they have in those early Olympian games? An olive wreath. Wasn't that big old gold medal hanging around their neck? Is that crown made from an olive branch? And that was laid upon their head. Well, how long was that crown going to last? Is that going to last as long as that gold medal? No, it's a perishable crown. It's not going to last very long. But that's not the kind of crown that we are running for. We are running for an imperishable crown. What kind of crown is that? What kind of crown is there that doesn't perish? It's an eternal crown. It's the crown that Jesus called, be thou faithful until death, and thou shalt receive the crown of life. It's an eternal crown. It's the crown that Paul talks about in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 8. He says, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness. Two different words used, crown of life, crown of righteousness, talking about the same imperishable crown. Is there anything about heaven that's going to perish? Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1, we have an inheritance that is incorruptible, that's undefiled, and it does not fade away. Was that Olympian's crown, was it perishable? Did it fade away after time? That's not the kind of crown we're running for. Thus, verse 26. Therefore, I run thus, but I'm not running with uncertainty. I'm not running without aim. I'm not running not knowing where I'm going. He says, I know where I'm running to, and thus I fight. But I'm not fighting as one who beats the air and doesn't know what he's fighting against and what he's fighting for. Notice he switches his metaphor here. The Christian life is like running a race, and then he switches. And now what's he referring to the Christian life like? It's a fight. What kind of fight? Is it the kind of fight that Horizontal Holland was involved in the army? Where was it, 14-0? That he went undefeated 14-0 in the army? That's what they called him, Horizontal Holland. Was it that kind of fighting where you laced on the... Did they have laces back then? Where they laced on the gloves and duked it out? Is that the kind of fighting that we're involved in as Christians? Hope not. Is that the kind of fighting we're involved in our homes? Hope not. What kind of fighting is this? When Paul says, I have fought the good fight, I have finished the course, I have kept the faith. What kind of fight was he involved in? What was that fight? When the Bible says to be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might, put on the whole armor of God. What kind of armor are we talking about? Is this a physical warfare? Are we fighting against flesh and blood? No. God says in that passage, it's against principalities, against the powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age. Is there a spiritual host of wickedness against which it wars against our soul? 1 Peter 2 and verse 11 says, abstain from fleshly lust that war against are we at war? Is the devil laying things out in front of us to go to war against us? Yeah. It's interesting that terminology is used here at the end of chapter 9, that we're running and we're fighting. The devil is challenging us at every turn. But here in this context, you get to chapter 10. And what does God tell us in chapter 10, verse 13 about these temptations? Not the singing group. The temptations that the devil lays out in front of us. What does he tell us about these temptations? Are they going to win? Is Satan the stronger foe? We could pick any movie, couldn't we? Did you all see some of the Rocky movies? I don't remember which Rocky it was where they went to Russia. And there's little old, what was his name? Italian stallion, Rocky Balboa. That's his name. There's little old Rocky. And then there's the big Russian guy. I can't remember his name. That was number 3. Thank you, movie buff. All right. Actually, I think it was number 4. Number 3 was Mr. T. You'll figure it out later. Just kidding. I have no idea. Okay, so when you looked at those two in the ring, now that we've got this great mental picture, you had a giant and you had a midget. You had Goliath and you had David. Which one is Satan? Is Satan the big guy in the ring? I mean, is he the one that has everything at his advantage? No. Bible says, no temptation's overtaken you but such as is common to man. But Satan is faithful. Does your Bible say that? Satan, he'll take care of you every time. You don't have to worry. What does it say? It's God who is faithful. 1 John chapter 5 in verse 4 says that he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. Who's the big one in the ring? Who's the giant in the ring? We're tempted to say, well, that's me. It must be me. Because if I'm greater than the one who's in the world, did God say that? Did God say that you are greater than the one who is in the world? Or did God say the one who is in you is greater than he who is in the world? Come back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. What does Paul say here? Paul says, I'm running. I'm fighting. Think about the imagery that gives for the Christian life. Is the Christian life something where we just lounge around and we take our ease? We eat, drink, and be merry for, you know, that's what this is all about. There's constant activity, constant battle. What word do you have in verse 20? But I do what? Verse 27, I'm sorry. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 27. I do what to my body? Keep it under subjection? What do you got in verse 27? What do you do to your body? What did he do to his body? Discipline? Anybody got anything different? Buffet? Beat? If you've got the word buffet, remember it's not buffet, okay? Some of us buffet our bodies really good, but that's not what he's talking about. I buffet, I beat, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. Both of those verbs, discipline and subject, are in the present tense, meaning this wasn't just something he did at one time. It is a continual thing that even the Apostle Paul had to keep coming back and bringing his body under control. Now, with Paul saying, I've got to discipline my body, I've got to bring it into subjection, go back to verse 24. Paul says, we're all running a race. Run in such a way that you may be able to obtain the prize. What is the in such a way? It's running, disciplining my body, controlling my body. Verse 25, everyone who competes for the prize is temperate, is controlled in all things. And Paul says, even I, the apostle Paul, have to subject my body, bring it into subjection, discipline my body. I have to learn to control myself lest when I have preached to others so that they can be saved, what might happen to him? He could fall away. He could become disqualified. Is that possible? Is it possible that the great apostle Paul could go out and preach and teach and establish congregations and baptize people into Christ, and he could get hundreds of people on the path to heaven, and then he could turn around and fall away and go to hell? The apostle Paul? That's what he just said. I have to learn to control my body, lest I do all of these things and I myself fall short. Ruth, you had your hand up. Say the first part of what you said again. I think I missed it. Yes. Absolutely. Did Paul have to learn to resist temptations? Were there temptations that Paul had to learn to control his urges towards? Was Paul above temptation? Was Jesus above temptation? Did Satan tempt the Lord? Now remember, there's a difference between being tempted and giving in to the temptation. Did Jesus have to control his urges to give in to temptations? If Jesus had to control those, Paul says he had to control them. What about me? Do I need to learn to control them, Stephen?
Well, you think about the disciples. What examples?
I want you to keep this in context. I want you to see what he's saying at the end of chapter 9, where he says, we are in a race. We're trying to reach the prize. The only way we can reach the prize is to run with endurance, a word from Hebrews 12, to stay on target, to know with certainty where we're going, to discipline our bodies. But then he gets to chapter 10. And he says, let me give you another example. He says in chapter 10, I don't want you to be unaware. It's not just me. Paul goes back to the Old Testament. And he goes back to the Old Testament, and we have studied this section of Scripture in the Old Testament frequently. And we have the same, we stand in awe at the stupidity of the Israelites, apparently the same way that they did. How in the world could you see all that God did to the Egyptians and then still complain and turn against God? How could you walk through the Red Sea on dry ground and then turn around and turn your back on God? How could you see all the manifestations of God and then build the golden calf? How could all of that happen and you still do that? That's what Paul says here in chapter 10. Paul says, here's these people that belong to God. He brought them out. But look what he says in verse 1. I don't want you to be unaware that all of our fathers, they were under the cloud. What cloud was that? When God brought Israel out of Egypt, when they came and they were camping in the Sinai Peninsula, when they got ready to go up to the Promised Land, how did they know when to leave? How did they know when to stop? Cloud by day, fire by night. I want you to see the word all in these first five verses, and then the switch to the word some as we get to some of these middle verses. All were under the cloud, verse 1. All passed through the sea. Which sea? The Red Sea. All, here's an interesting phrase, were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They were baptized? What does that mean? What does it mean that the Israelites were baptized in the cloud and in the sea? What does it mean to be baptized? What does the word mean? To be immersed? When one is immersed in water, when somebody is immersed in water, here's his body. His body is in the water. Is he surrounded by that water? Is he passing through that water? Is there any part of him that is not affected by that water? He is immersed. He's submerged. He's plunged into that water. Paul says, when they passed through that on dry ground, it was as if they had been baptized. Now, baptized into who here? Into Moses. When someone obeys the gospel of Christ today, they're baptized into Christ. What does that mean? Baptized into Christ. I put on Christ. I become a follower of Christ. Could I be a follower of Moses if I was not under that cloud? And if I did not pass through that sea, what if I said, "What? Well, I don't want to have anything to do with that. You know, I think I'll just go get a boat and I'll go down a little bit south here and I'll just get across the Red Sea on my own and I'll meet you all on the other side." See, a follower of Moses? Has he been baptized in the cloud and in the sea? Oh, he's just choosing his own path. They all experienced this. They all ate, verse 3, of the same spiritual food. They all drank of the same spiritual drink. Are they beneficiaries of the blessings of God? How many of them? All of them. They drank the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, notice the change. All under the cloud, all through the sea, all baptized, all ate, all drink. But, verse 5, with most of them, God was not well pleased. Was God not well pleased with all of them? No, just with most of them. Isn't that interesting? Jesus said there's a wide way and there is a narrow way. Where are most people? What path are most people traveling? The wide way. Is God displeased with most people? And the path that they are taking in their life, is he displeased with all people? No, there were still some. There were still some who were following him, but with most he was not well pleased. You wanted to see the evidence of it? Their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. You remember when they went to the Promised Land and the spies came back and said, "Oh, we can't do it." God was giving it to them and they came up with that word "can't." "Hey, we can't do it." And so God said, "Okay, you can't do it. So now you won't do it." Send them into the wilderness for 40 years. Now these things, verse 6, these things that are recorded about them, they became for us our examples. What's an example? What does it mean that these accounts in the Old Testament, they became an example for us? For us to learn by? Is it possible for a parent or a teacher to make an example out of somebody else? Out of one of the children? What does that mean? I'm going to make an example out of him. I'm going to teach him a lesson. And by the very fact that I'm going to teach him a lesson, is somebody else going to learn the lesson? Using him as an example, he'll learn it. But other people will learn it too who see it and read about it. God says these things happened to them. Now they're for our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, because they also lusted. Don't do what they did. Is it important for us to learn from history? Is it important for us to learn from the mistakes of others? Here are some mistakes of others that God says you need to learn from. Don't lust after evil things like they lusted. Verse 7, do not become idolaters as were, look at the word, not all of them. Did they all become idolaters? No. Do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, and this is what was said when they made the golden calf in Exodus chapter 32, it is said that the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. It was all about them and all about their service to their new God, and it wasn't about God. Verse 8, nor let us commit sexual immorality. As who did? All of them? No, not all of them. But some of them did. Don't let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 fell. You go back to the book of Numbers and you read about that plague that was brought upon God's people. Has sexual immorality been a problem for a long time? Is there something we ought to learn? If 23,000 people died in one day as a result of sexual immorality, what should that say to us? I don't want to have anything to do with it. Nor let us, verse number 9, nor let us tempt Christ. As how many of them? All of them? No, not all of them. Nor let us tempt or test or try Christ, as some of them also tempted or tested and tried him and were destroyed by serpents. Remember the story in Numbers 21 where God sent those serpents among them? It's because they were trying the will of God. Nor let us complain, verse 10. Here's a verse we need to know. The easy one to remember is over in Philippians 2 and verse 14. Do all things without complaining and murmuring. There's going to be a lesson during our lectureship. Dan Winkler is going to be speaking on our lectureship on Friday night. 7 verses to write on the doorpost of your home. And this is not one of the verses he uses because I've already had his outline. But Philippians 2:14 might be a good verse for you to write on the doorpost of your house. Do all things without complaining and murmuring. And then if you wrote it on the doorpost of your house, you could point it out to your husband. You wouldn't even have to say anything. You know, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1 says that she without a word, didn't say just pointed, she without a word might win her husband. She could just point, that's on the doorpost of our house. Stop your complaint. You could point it out to your kids. Sherrick said something. I didn't fully understand. I didn't fully, grasp the. I think his wife will explain the way more perfectly to him when he gets home along that line. Would it be good for us to write this on the doorpost or the forehead of our children? Do all think. What about complaining in verse 10? Don't let us complain. Oh, no, no. Did the Israelites complain? Like every day. Nor complain as some, did all of them complain? Whew, at least it wasn't all of them. Boy, Moses thought it was all of them, didn't he? I mean, if you've got a lot of people complaining, doesn't it seem like everybody's complaining? Isn't that the thing that we do is when something is happening, we exaggerate? Kid comes home from school. Everybody at school was mean to me. Really? I mean, everybody? You know, there's 2,000 kids in your high school, and you're telling me that we just exaggerate the point. Huh? I told them a million times. You were counting pretty steady there. I'm up to 900. Okay, so here we go. Don't complain, as some of them complain. And what happened to them? They were destroyed by the destroyer. Verse 11 picks up where verse 6 was. Now, all these things happened to them as examples. We need to learn. And they were written for our admonition, you might have. You might have instruction. These things were written to teach us something. Are we learning? That's the question. Are we learning? Those upon whom the ends of the ages have come, that's us living in the New Testament era. These things were written so that we could learn. Therefore, verse 12. Therefore, think about what he said in chapter 9. I run, I fight, I discipline my body. I got to bring it into subjection. Even Paul says he has to do that. Here were the Israelites. All of the blessings of God the Israelites had, and they still were falling. Verse 12. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands, I'm okay, I'm doing all right, watch out. Take heed lest he fall. What does that do to the doctrine of Calvinism that says once you're saved, you're always saved and you don't need to worry about it? God just said, Paul just said, even about himself, I better watch out. If you get cocky, you get confident, you think you're okay, watch out. Even you can fall. But verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful. He's not going to allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation, He is going to make a way of escape so that you may be able to bear it. Is that not your favorite verse in 1 Corinthians? Stephen? It's not a removal of it, to bear up under it, is to endure up under it. It's the idea of remaining underneath that burden, but yet God's going to provide a way of escape. I want you to see a couple more verses. I know we've got, what, 1 minute? We got 1 minute. Look at verse 24. In this context, I want to finish this context of remembering our responsibilities towards others and their souls and not having to exercise our rights and freedoms all the time. Verse 24, let no one seek his own, but each the other's well-being. He says in verse 25, if you go to the market and there's meat there that's been sacrificed to an idol, buy it, eat it. Everything on the earth is given to us by God to eat. But if you are invited to dinner, verses 27 and 28, if you're invited to dinner at somebody's house and there's somebody there who's eating and says, that meat was sacrificed to an idol, Paul says, don't eat it. Because we do not want to offend that weaker conscience. Look down at verse 31. Therefore, whether you eat or you drink, and I like this next phrase, or whatever you do, what does that include? Anything not included in whatever you do? Colossians 3:17, whatever you do, do all in the name of, by the authority of Christ. Whatever you do, what do? Do all of it. How much of it? Whatever you do, everything's in there. Do all of it. Nothing is excluded. Do all of it to the glory of God. There's all sorts of folks who want to manipulate and twist and turn Scripture and say, well, it's okay for me to do that, it's okay for me to do that. Here is a great litmus test for everything that we do. By doing this, is it going to bring glory to God? Is that why we're here? Isaiah 53 and verse 7 says, we were created for God's glory. There needs to be a filter in my head before I say or do anything. Is this going to bring glory? Do all to the glory of God. Don't offend. Don't be a stumbling block to the Jews, to the Greeks, to the people in the church. Don't be that person. Don't seek your own profit, the end of verse 33. But seek the salvation of other souls. That needs to be paramount. Not the exercising of what I want to do. Do all to the glory of God. Do it so that people can be saved and go to heaven. And I don't like the chapter division here because I think chapter 11 and verse 1 ties right into everything he's just said. Imitate me as I also imitate Christ. Are there some liberties and some rights that we might have that we can forego so that we can save a brother's soul? You know, it's not always all about us. Sometimes we get that self-important image. Paul says, I'm not going to do anything to seek self. I'm going to do everything to seek others. I'm going to do everything to glorify God. And Paul says, how about it? Are you going to do that too? Imitate me. Not just me, but imitate me as I imitate Christ. Thank you all for your good attention. Thank you for letting us finish that chapter. Joe? 4:0. 4. I'm missing it.
Not 14.
What did I say?
14.
14. It's 4. It was 4. Not 14. Remember the baskets in the back for the corn roast if you can help with that. Thank you all very much.